We're not even at halfway point, right? But in a few days, you'll be going back to your homes. Those of you from out of town, you'll be going back home. And even those of us who are here in Tucson will be settling back into whatever our normal routines are, whether we work or whether we're tired or whatever, we'll get back into the normal 9-to-5 routine or whatever it is your daily schedule calls for. And a phenomenon or a syndrome that I've noticed going back over my over 50 years in a church is this, that there exists the great possibility that you could be kind of disappointed with the ending of the feast and having to go back home to your normal routine. After all, you've been here for the Feast of Tabernacles. You know what it means. We're celebrating the return of Jesus Christ to this earth and ruling this earth for 1,000 years, and all of that is great information. We go through the scriptures, and we have sermons and sermonettes that talk about all of the things that we won't have to face, or that mankind won't have to face then, that we all have to face now, and everybody does, but I think we have a much greater heightened sense of awareness of the difficulties of this world, because God is with us and helps us to understand the difference between this world and the next. Am I right? So, there exists the possibility that you're facing the 21st century when you go back home. Is it possible there could be a letdown of sorts, mentally, spiritually, to some extent? Because being able to cope with life after the feast is finished, I think, is a special need in the Church of God, because it's normal to have a letdown, and I think there's a special way that we can prepare for that time, especially in the times that we're living. We're kind of insulated at the feast. I mean, at least for me, I'm a little bit more shut off from what's happening in the world and more focused in on getting to services on time and, you know, getting ready for this special time that we're together and fellowshipping, so I don't have as much time to really spend on doing things that I would normally do and that make me aware. I kind of cut out watching TV news a number of years ago, and so I rely on other sources, but I don't have as much time to spend on that. But I know when I get back, there's going to be plenty of bad news to absorb, and that's one of those things that just happens. In the times that we're living in, who can deny that it's much different than anything that we have ever known? I mean, it's almost like it's accepted as a normal thing. Oh, 2 assassination attempts on ex-President Trump, and oh yeah, that, well, it's just one of those things because people hate him. But and it's just like, wow. I'm thinking that in times past, this would have been much bigger news and a much more shocking thing, and yet people have become somewhat accustomed to it. And I heard that just yesterday there was an attempted assassination on the Prime Minister of Israel with a drone attack, and that was unsuccessful, thankfully. But then as we get back in just a couple of weeks, we're going to have what I feel, and I think I'm probably in agreement with a lot of other people that are a lot more expert than I am, in the most consequential U.S. presidential election that has ever been in our history. And I really know a little bit about these things because I followed politics since I was a little kid, since I was 10 or 11. I've mentioned to our local people that I grew up in a little town in northwestern Maryland, which was 5 miles from Camp David, the presidential retreat. It was in the Catoctin Mountains. We didn't live in the mountains, but we lived in the valley and where there were orchards and, you know, rolling hills and all that sort of thing. But the presidential news and news about Washington was very close to us because we were in close proximity to Washington. And so we were always, and my parents were always interested in what was happening in the world. But so I've been tuned into that sort of thing. And it's going to be important because there was a famous baseball player who played for the New York Yankees. And when he joined the Yankees, he told everybody, and he was right, but he told his name was Reggie Jackson, he told everybody that he was the straw that stirred the drink. And a lot of people took offense at that, but actually he went to the Yankees and they won, I think 3 World Series in a row. And he was a great baseball player, but he wasn't necessarily being arrogant, he was just being accurate, but a lot of people thought he was arrogant. But the U.S. is the straw that stirs the drink for the rest of the world. We can't deny that. It's the most important nation in the history of the world, and they're coming up to what I think most people would agree are the most important presidential elections, because the world has changed. the differences between candidates are much more severe than they used to be. So if you watch people like Tucker Carlson or listen to people like Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, many other people are saying that America is at a crossroads in a decision making, and it's really going to be hard to predict exactly what will happen at this particular time. We'll take a look at Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 19, which kind of defines some of what we have been experiencing and what we're supposed to experience. And if we're not careful, we could lose a little bit as we leave the feast. But it says that in the New King James Version, rejoice is mentioned seven times in this book, in the book of Ecclesiastes. And as you know, it's already been pointed out that rejoicing is one of the themes of the Feast of Tabernacles. In fact, we're told in Deuteronomy 12 that that is what we are supposed to do. We're supposed to rejoice during this time. And why not? Because of what it pictures. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 19, it says, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, that would include all of us, I think, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage, and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. And that is such a memory of what you do all year long in preparing for the feast and saving your money, saving your second tithe, and making sure that you're ready to come to the feast, and then you can enjoy all of that, the gift of your labor. That's the gift of God. And I watched last few days, I kind of can't help but notice this. I watch all of you, you're getting along, you're socializing, you're getting to meet new people, you're having fun. And while you're keeping the feast here, you're enjoying every minute of it. You've captured the essence of keeping the holy days. Kudos to you. You've made the feast very, very positive with your positive attitude, your positive energy, and the Spirit of God. And you're doing this knowing that the time is coming when Jesus Christ is coming back to rule this earth with justice and peace, and that's what brings the greatest joy to all of us. And we've already been greatly encouraged by the messages that have outlined the future. So my premise is this: for a lot of people, getting back to the routine of normal life can be an adjustment. If you're leaving this, you're going back to your homes, and whatever your daily activity is, it could be a challenging assignment for all of you. So while we're not even at the halfway point of the feast yet, what I'd like to do today is outline several powerful tools, thoughts, and ideas that you can begin using these immediately, and probably you already have done so, or at least think about them before you leave for the feast. And what I'd like to encourage you to do is to put them into practice now as much as you possibly can, so that you can cope with life in the 21st century outside of the Feast of Tabernacles before Jesus Christ establishes his kingdom. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? My goal is that you don't have a post-feast letdown, as happens to some people mentally or spiritually, and rather than feeling badly about leaving the feast and leaving Tucson and going back home, that you'd be empowered to embrace the next weeks and the next year after this. Let's turn to Romans chapter 11 and verse 30. The first point in this step is one I think a lot of you have really tapped into, and you understand and you realize through your great association with the Church of God and with the wisdom that God has given to you. I think you've tumbled upon this already, but the first point, the first powerful tool that I'd like to encourage you to continue to develop is examine your attitude toward your fellow man. Examine your attitude toward your fellow man. Be honest with yourself and how you feel about your fellow man. Can I speak bluntly and candidly? I think I can in this group. Nobody's going to report me, right, if I speak bluntly and candidly. I believe that there was, and I've been in the church for over 50 years, okay? So I'm not speaking bad about the church or government or administration or ministers or anything that comes from the pulpit. I'm not doing this. I'm just stating what I believe to be somewhat factual. And depending on when you came into the church, it might be truer or less true to a certain extent. But I believe that There were times in the past when we may have erred a little bit, not intentionally, of course, maybe some more than others, but I think that we can all remember times in which those outside of the fellowship of the Church of God were sometimes belittled and maybe even looked down upon. It almost sometimes seemed to be a us versus them type of mentality. Because some of you will remember that sometimes people outside the walls of the church were called outsiders, the unconverted, or this is the worst, the world. That's the worst thing. So at times in my experience, it seems as though we forgot our own origins. Because Paul says in Romans 11 and verse 30, and there's four or five other scriptures I could add in here as well, but this is enough. For you were once disobedient to God, yet now have obtained mercy through their disobedience. You know, somewhere along the line, at some point in our history, sometimes we forgot that. Hey, we were the them at one time. We were the people, outsiders, unconverted, you know, unrepentant, sinners. In verse 31 of Romans 11, it says, even so these also have now been disobedient, that through the mercy shown you, they may obtain mercy. You know, that is the whole key of what we're doing now, is that we're going to be working with a lot of people before the end of this age, and we're going to be working with people forever that come from the same kind of backgrounds that we do. So you may have adjusted your thinking. I applaud you for doing so. I applaud you and give you kudos for kind of adjusting your thinking. But if maybe it's a good reminder for all of us from time to time to remember where we came from. And boy, I'm reminded of that every day. And like I've said in the last 5 or 6 months to our local congregation, the church truly saved my life. I know it did. I don't know what was ahead of me, you know, but I know when I took that fork in the road to the church and was called of God, I know it was a tremendous blessing. Even though, let's face it, we're always going to have problems and difficulties and whatever in the faith and the church, and that doesn't matter. You know, as far as you are concerned, you know, you need to be grounded and understand where you came from. There's an interesting story in Luke 9. It's kind of totally out of bounds when it comes to treating others how people should be treating. And you'll find find it begins in Luke chapter 9 and verse 51. To set the stage for this short story, you're probably aware of the antagonism that existed between the Jews and the Samaritans of the first century AD, right? The Samaritan people had been transplanted into northern Israel from far away when Assyria carried the 10 tribes of Israel captive. So they brought these other people, didn't know God, they didn't have the truth of God, but eventually they learned a little part of it from maybe some of the Jews, but they were inhabiting this area. They brought their own religious practices in, mixed a little bit of that with some of the truth, some of the 10 commandments, and some of that. And that was, you know, they had their own little belief system, which was obviously incorrect. But the Jews looked down upon him, as we know. And the Samaritans probably didn't like that very well. And sometimes they retaliated, as, you know, this story seems to indicate. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 51, it says, now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. Because that was his purpose. That was his intent. He was determined to go to Jerusalem to fulfill his mission, or a part of it. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. So some of the disciples were sent on ahead. You know, this is kind of probably a halfway stopping point where you'd have maybe to stop at an inn or stay overnight or whatever. They're walking great distances, but they were there to stay in Samaria for the night. And so the disciples went in to prepare. So from his hometown area, Samaria would have been a place for them to stop and rest for the night maybe. And so they could make preparations to continue on. It says in verse 53, but they did not receive him because his face was set for the journey of Jerusalem. Maybe some of them were offended. He's not going to hang around. Now, Christ had had other dealings with the Samaritans in John 4. I mean, there was an incredible incredible awakening and our awareness because of his encounter with a woman at the well, and you'll remember that story. And then all the Samaritans came out to him, and she told them, hey, this guy's, he knows everything about my life. He's truly a prophet. You remember that story. But they knew at this time that his intent was not to stay long or to make Samaria the focal point of his journey, and so they didn't make any accommodation for him. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did? It's almost funny, right? If it wasn't such a tragic thought process, it's almost a funny thing when you think about it. Okay, they kind of caused a small offense. Shall we burn them up right now? But he turned and rebuked them and said, you don't know what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. So the moral of the story is, it's hard to work with people in the future if you've turned them into crispy critters. I mean, it's just not going to be a thing. So maybe we can relate to that in terms of our attitude to those that are not yet called of God, because there's going to be a lot of them before Jesus Christ returns. There's going to be a lot of people called to the truth, and who's going to be there to help them? A bunch of people that want to call down fire from heaven because they got long hair, or they got a tattoo, or they do this or that? No. It's going to be people like you that understand because you've come from the same place as they have. So hopefully any kind of superiority attitude that we ever had regarding people outside of the faith is over with. But as we contemplate the story in the next chapter, I'll summarize it. We're not going to go to chapter 10. But it's the time in which Christ sent out the 70. And he said that there's a great work to be done. And he said the fields are white with the harvest, right? And they're ready for the harvest. And so we have to be ready. And the work of preaching the gospel remains. And how much any of us will be able to contribute before our life ends, and maybe some of us will die before Christ's return. I hope not. But we always know that that's a possibility, right? It's something can happen to any of us at any time. But there's going to be a continuing work until Jesus returns to set up his kingdom. Therefore, knowing that people like us will be called, will we be ready to accept them? Now, I'm very proud of my local congregation. I guess I'm prejudiced, but I've been told by many people who visit us that they're among the friendliest group of people that they've ever met. And so I really feel like they would do an excellent job welcoming anybody that's new to the faith into our congregation. And I give all the credit to the individual members. But that is very much like a kingdom approach, a kingdom mentality. I spoke about having a kingdom mentality several weeks ago before we kept the feast. And you can start with those that you come in contact with right now. Those of you that are, just a few examples, those of you go out to lunch, you got a server, you got somebody there that's serving you, tip well. Maybe because you've got a little bit more money, tip more than you normally would. And then write no tax on tips, by the way, too, and say MAGA as well. And then just kidding. Just so there's no confusion. Randy, you do the same thing over there. I know you do it. Come on. Randy's getting embarrassed for me. Steve, you're treading on thin ice. I know what he's thinking there. So, But at the hotel, you get free breakfast, you get free drinks in the evening. Oh, this is great, all this free stuff. Well, somebody's got to prepare that. They've got a tip jar, I'm sure. I mean, I haven't been over there to look at it, but I've stayed in dozens of embassy suites, and there's servers and people cooking food and everything. Put some money in the jar. Help them out. Make a good name for yourself and the church, which you've always done. So the main thing is, evaluate how you feel about people outside of this room. Treat them like a king would treat them. Point number two of three. Point number two, understand the times. This is going to be a very powerful tool for you as you make your way back to your home after the Feast of Tabernacles. Understand the times, and understand how you receive information about the age that we're living in. I think that's one of the most important things for the Church of God and for Christians right now. And I hope that this Feast of Tabernacles will be a spiritual springboard for you to supercharge your spiritual alertness throughout the year to come. But we've got to be aware of the factors that are actively working against that effort of us to be informed and to be knowledgeable about the world that we live in. In the Olivet Prophecy, and you know where to find those, of course, in the Olivet Prophecy, Christ said that deception would be great in the time of the end, and it would be so great that it could even affect the elect of God in Matthew 24 and verse 24. In fact, deception is one of the major themes of the Olivet Prophecy. It's so important that it's mentioned four times in the Olivet Prophecy. So as you evaluate this age now, and when you return back to your normal routine, be aware of the potential roadblocks, including deception, but also what I call normalcy bias. What is normalcy bias? It's something that we became more aware of during the time of COVID. Normalcy bias, because we yearn for consistency and normalcy in our lives. And as you began to see the regulations and the restrictions be loosened at the end of the COVID crisis, everybody breathed a sigh of relief and said, oh man, I'm so glad that's all over. We're back to normal, and kind of we are. But everything changed during the time of COVID. And what this has revealed to us is very important in understanding the times, because it will come again. It will come again. We're not going to stay normal like this forever. I mean, I'm not a prophet, but I just have a feeling that to understand the world in which we live, you have to be aware that the noose will tighten at some particular point. So now that some of those things are over, some of the things that happened, and I'll speak about those in just a moment, some of those things are over, and take a step back. Take a look at the forces that shaped our behaviors, because there was a global response to the COVID crisis, something that has never taken place on this earth before, because the same measures were enacted everywhere, which is unique in human history. And whether you were offended by them or you were not, you'll have to agree that they happened in a synchronized, organized fashion, rolled out throughout the entire world for something that actually was dangerous for a small group of the population. And I come from a medical background, so I'm not trying to speak like a know-it-all, but I'm just saying that the reaction was unified and it was directed to all the population of the earth for the most part. Now, some nations didn't participate, but this global response had never taken place before. Masking, distancing. I told friends, look, this is dumb. Masking is stupid. I lost some friends over it. People didn't like the fact that I said what I thought. I mean, people wearing a silk mask on an airplane and, you know, you're not stopping a thing. You're not stopping anything. And if they tell you to do it again, my advice is don't do it, because you're causing more harm to yourself than good. And I still see people in supermarkets, and sometimes the people that work in the supermarkets are wearing these masks, and it's, I feel like sometimes, and I don't do it, I feel like sometimes, oh, can I ask you a question? Why are you wearing that mask? And I don't do it, you know, I'm going to pat myself on the back for not doing that, but I knew it was a hoax then. And social distancing, which I made a joke, everybody social distance around Terry because she didn't want anybody stepping her foot. Bring it back. The closures, the travel restrictions, the shopping capacity limits, the small companies and business not being allowed to operate while the giant mega companies flourished. All these methods were universally accepted, and good luck if you tried to oppose it at that time, because you'd be vilified in many cases. And in a like manner, what you've seen in the last few years with the modern democracies of the world and Europe and the English-speaking nations, many of the English-speaking nations, especially this nation, All of them have been facing an illegal migrant crisis at exactly the same time, and this has caused economic, social, and political upheaval. I don't care what your political leanings are. You just have to admit that it's happened. And it's caused political unrest. It's caused social unrest. It's caused economic fallout for these fairly wealthy nations of Western Europe and the United States to do this. And so we find when we dig a little deeper, is we have these agencies like nobody paid attention to them in the past. The World Health Organization, the WHO, they developed and scripted a response to COVID, and then the foundations were established, and they created what are called non-governmental organizations to be heavily involved in the illegal immigrant crisis, and that's what's happening in the nation, and they're funded by the government. So what I'm saying is it's a forerunner of what could happen in the future, a global response to what is perceived to be a threat or a problem. And instead of nations acting in their own determined self-interest to thwart a problem that they're facing, the ideas of how to deal with this come from others. And of course, that leads us to Revelation 13, others, and that's a whole different ball of wax, but it's a prelude to all of those things that will be dictates that will be enforced. I'd like to point out what I've pointed out to our local congregation here recently, two important, what I think are the two most important aspects of Bible prophecy at this particular time that are unfolding before our eyes, and it probably will tend to get worse. We might have a respite, who knows, but Ephesians 6 and verse 12 is where I'd like to go next. Understanding that this system is in place now, and it's designed to deceive you. It's designed to deceive even the very elect, as it says in the Olivet prophecy. Paul said, "We don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities." So in other words, we can't see the threat. We can't see the real threat. We may see human threats, but we can't see, and because we can't see it, it may be a tendency to overlook the problem because the problem, the majority of the problem, is invisible. We're wrestling in a spiritual fashion against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age. And if that was true 2,000 years ago, how much more true is it today? That's where the enemy is. That's in that darkness against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. Those heavenly places are not in the third heavens where God is. They're in the heavens of this air and this earth because that's where the devil has been marooned since his rebellion, detailed in Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. But understand that this system is designed to deceive you. So when you're ever tempted to say, "Oh, they wouldn't do that." Have you said that in the last couple of years? "They wouldn't do that." Chances are they're already doing it. They're doing it already. And 2 Timothy chapter 3 helps frame the world that we're living in today. And these are two important aspects of Bible prophecy that, you know, maybe just keep them in mind as we move forward, and that will help you to deal with the world that you're actually living in. Not to be negative while we're talking about all the great things that are going to happen for 1,000 years, but look, we have to deal with the world today. It's reality. So 2 Timothy 3, in the first part of the chapter, Paul warned Timothy that perilous times would come. We're not going to go to each verse, but and he said that some men, not every single person on the face of the earth, but some men would be unthankful, they would be unholy, they would be unloving, they would be unforgiving, and they would be despisers of good. Now, years ago, when I first came into the church, we read this scripture, and the disobedient to parents, and yeah, look at that sassy teenager, he's sassy to his parents, look at that Bible prophecy coming to pass. No, it's a far grander scale and more evil and more diabolical than that, because this describes many leaders who are charting a course for the destruction of this world as we speak. In 2 Timothy 3 and verse 13, it says, "Evil men and impostors will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. And all along, as they become more evil, they accumulate more power to accomplish their devilish goals," which is where we began this thread in Ephesians chapter 6. Now, I think that there's possibly the misunderstood significance of Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2. And I was a college student in Brickettwood, England, at Ambassador College when I first had this explained. I believe it was in a Bible study that Mr. Armstrong gave, and he was speaking about this theme in Ephesians 2, about the prince of the power of the air, and he was describing how Satan works in attitudes. Many of you were around at that time, and you remember exactly what I'm saying, right? And he was right, and he was exactly right, and he revealed something to us at that particular time. It was explained that Satan is indeed the prince of the power of the air of this earth, and he broadcasts his message in attitudes to others. And his deadly attitudes are comprised of hate and lawlessness and spiritual wickedness, and all of that is very, very true. And in verse 2, we read, in which you once walked, according to the course of this world. Because, again, going back to what I'd said previously about this, where we came from, we were all affected to a certain extent by the world, by the human nature, by the way of this world. But it even goes much deeper than that when we speak about Bible prophecy. And here's what I'm getting at. When you couple this with what Paul warned Timothy about, and then you realize that this spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. You see, the effect of that broadcasting is picked up like a receiver, so much greater with the people that Paul describes in 2 Timothy 3 as being unholy, unthankful, unloving, ungodly. That's where this reception really finds its signal. And so you find that people that really don't believe in God, have no basis or moral code or functioning in that way, they're different than you believe. Many of them are in unique and powerful and incredibly powerful leadership positions in this world, but they're rebellious to God and His laws. And it doesn't really do any good to mention any names. I kind of like to do it myself sometimes, but it doesn't really do any good to mention any names. But you probably mentally line up some of these people that were responsible for some of the decision-making that was really an enslavement of mankind in many, many ways during the times of COVID. How many of them, when you think about these influential people, how many of them would you really put in the category as being God-fearing, loving God, even having a nominal understanding or acceptance of the Ten Commandments in their life? And I think if you're thinking about the same people I'm thinking about, you'd say, none of those. And that is where this influence is greater than anywhere else. And this brings us back to your neighbor. More than likely, your neighbor is a nice guy who watches your house when you're gone, right? He's not the guy you need to fear. He's not some ungodly, unholy, unworkable type of individual. So maybe a change is due for your attitude toward him and maybe a lot of other people as well. Last point. Think and act like a king. You know, today you have an opportunity to show your royal lineage, your background. As we close the message today, I want to leave you with four powerful keys in thinking and acting like a king. And they're real simple. Adopt them. Use them. Make them a part of your life, as you probably already have. The first one is wisdom. And I'm going to reference 1 Kings 3 and verse 9. And we know that Solomon was the wisest man who ever lived. And he may have had many problems, but we can acknowledge that indeed he was wise. He was a wise king. And he prayed to God for an understanding heart in verse 9 so that he could judge your people, that I may judge and discern between the good and the evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours?" And in verse 10, this speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. He didn't ask for riches. He didn't ask for great wealth or long life for himself. He asked for wisdom so he could be with God's people. That is one of the ways in thinking and acting like a king, because you can ask for wisdom too. And we've had some initiatives. I'm sure Mr. Love has had initiatives in his area about reading the book of Proverbs and going through. There's usually in every month, there's a day for every chapter, and you can do that. You can ask God for wisdom and do that. That is what a king does. Ask God for wisdom to think and act like a king. And maybe read Proverbs, which is filled with little bits of wisdom all the time. It is well known by all of us that the greatest attributes Christ enumerated about being a king by his example and by instruction was humility and service. Wisdom, humility, service. 1, 2, 3. Real simple. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it. Wisdom, humility, service. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 18, which many of you just recently read this and reviewed all of this, and you know that you remember this instruction that was given for the future kings of Israel, that what they were to do. It shows the instruction to the kings of Israel to copy the law in their own hand. You know, just to write it out. People have asked me, "Hey, should we do that? Should we copy the Bible in our own hand?" That would be a lot. They didn't have as much to copy back then. It wasn't as much of a Bible, but it wasn't as much of the law to copy. But I don't think so. I don't think you need to do that with all the tools that are available to implant the Word of God into your head and to study on a regular basis. And to have a, you know, like I like to do, is take a journal book. Like, if you haven't got one, pick one up at the back. Take one, they're free. Journal, you know, write down your thoughts and take notes and that sort of thing. And I think that that's probably really good, and your intention is increased with note-taking. The same thing is true with this instruction that was given to kings, because it developed a faithfulness. So four attributes of being a king and thinking like a king are wisdom, humility, service, and faithfulness to God. These will keep you on the right track. You can do that now. You can think and act like a king. It's kind of like a speech that a football coach gave to my son's 9th grade class many years ago, James, the one sitting in the front with his children now today listening. But when James was in 9th grade, he said, "Dad, I want to go out for the freshman football team." I said, "Go have at it, have fun." So to put it bluntly, they were not really good at all. He went to school that was kind of a football powerhouse, and had been a football powerhouse for a long time on the far northeast side of town, Sabino High School. It was kind of actually like a football factory for many years and had won state championships and everything. But the team James was on, was his freshman squad, was they were bad. Well, they were 7-1. They were 7-1, 7 losses, 1 win. I knew where I was going with that. Now, they would say they were 1-7. And so every year at a banquet, a sports team, they have banquets and everything. And so, you know, they had a banquet which consisted of all the parents, all of us getting together. I mean, every Thursday, we would go see his team. Every Thursday afternoon, late afternoon, or maybe even early into the evening, we would make the trip to Desert View or to Saguaro or whoever they were playing to see them get walloped and to see them get thrown all over the field. And I don't know what it was about them that they were just so bad as 9th graders, but they were completely horrible. At Desert View, which is on the southeast side of town, Terry and I went to that. We were cringing. We thought, none of these boys will ever want to play sports again after they got rolled 66-0 by this team that themselves, they weren't very good. I mean, they weren't good. And they had never been a football powerhouse. Their 9th grade team cleaned the clocks of the Sabino kids. And it was embarrassing, and it was kind of, I don't remember it being a happy time at all for James. But anyway, so there's nothing more to this story. It's over. It's a bit. That's it. It's, life sucks. You know, it's too bad. No, the atmosphere of the cafeteria where they had the awards. Nobody got an award, by the way. Nobody got anything. There was no special outcome that anybody had done individually that deserved a medal or a ribbon or anything else. They were pretty downcast. They had a bad. I don't even know how they won that one game. I mean, to be honest with you, that may have been a forfeit. As a matter of fact, that may have been the one win where the other team didn't show up. I don't know. Sorry, but the head coach of the varsity team came to that banquet. And I was shocked when he got up. He's the last speaker, and he was known to be a very, very motivational speaker. And with entirely great confidence and conviction, he told the boys how special they were. He said, "You're special to be alive. You're special that you were born." Seriously, and he was very serious. He says, "You know, you live in the greatest country of the world. You've got everything ahead of you." And he says, "You're winners." He said, "Now, I know that the outcome of the season was not so great for you because they were really losers. But the outcome of the season was not so good." But he went on to explain, and this is the one that shocked me. I mean, after this dismal season and showing, and, you know, the bean salad doesn't taste so good when you're 1-7 at an awards banquet, by the way. But he said to those boys, he said, "I believe you are winners because I believe you are going to be winners." He says, as a matter of fact, "If you stick in our program, I can guarantee by the time you are seniors, you will be playing for the state championship." And at that time, their school was playing in the second highest level or classification of schools in all of Arizona, which is 4A, 5A, and then I think they even have 6A now, but so it's changed a little bit. But they beat, eventually, in his senior year, they beat a lot of 5A schools that were much, much, much bigger, greater enrollment. But that speech was so unbelievable. I never forgot it. And James never forgot it either. Because as those boys, the ones that stuck with the program over the next 4 years, and they went into weightlifting, and they went into training during the summertime, and they worked hard, and they got results, and they worked, and they worked, and they worked. And by the senior year of those boys, they did win the state championship in the state of Arizona. No kidding, no joke. Now that's sports, and not everybody's into sports, but it just shows you what can happen with a dream. And when somebody has confidence in you, and when somebody expresses a can-do attitude, it's a mental challenge to turn things around from being a bunch of losers to being winners. And the locker room is a lot happier after a year of 12-0 than 1-7. And you know why? Because people are elated, not just because they won, but because they prove something to themselves. That the work in the off season and the lifting weights and the daily routines and the thought-by-thought progression and acting like a champion or acting like a king actually brings you to that point. So what does that have to do with you? Well, I think I'm not going to call all of you a bunch of losers right now, okay? Because I don't have to, really, do I? The Bible outlines that we are the weak of the world and that we have been brought into this congregation of the Church of God to make changes in our lives, correct? To not stay the same, but to make change. And we do that in much the same way as an athlete does on the day-by-day progression of working hard and preparing for the future. You're special, but in a much different way than this football coach told young men that they were special, and he really meant it. You've been called to be a king. You've been called by God the Father to work with his Son for 1,000 years to prepare people for eternity. If that doesn't get the motors of your motivation revving, then I don't have much more for you. I've left it on the field. This world that we inhabit is on a collision course with the final events of this age. I think you know how special it is to be called to salvation. And Mr. Horchak touched upon this the other day when he talked about the very slight percentage of who gets that call to repentance in this age. If you want to tackle life now, today, and when you get home and you want to face down that post-feast letdown, then examine your attitude of other people, understand the times we live in, and think and act like a champion. Think and act like a king.